We look at what's happening in other places in the world. You know, like currently it's Ukraine, and we look and judge and say how terrible and evil Putin is for invading Ukraine. But how does America stand when it's judged by that standard? Welcome to The Conquering Truth. I'm Dan Horn.
I'm Jonathan Sides.
I'm Charles Churchill.
And I'm Joshua Horn.
You know, as we look at a situation like Ukraine, where Putin gives his reasons for going in there, he says that, you know, they're a threat on his western flank, that he shouldn't have a country next to him that has leaders that really have alliances with other people other than him, since he's a major power. So he says that gives him the right to invade. And one of the things that I think we want to discuss tonight is, so if we look at that as a standard for America, how would America measure up by that standard?
You know, it's important to be consistent about these type of things, you know, because hypocrisy is something it's a bad thing. It's something that we see all too often in, you know, politics and everyday life. But when you get to the national stage, it's still a bad thing to be hypocritical. And, you know, another thing is it's really self-defeating if you are being hypocritical, because, you know, the media, the U.S. government, all kinds of Western nations are saying all these things about how bad Russia is. But if we are actually being hypocrites by saying that, we have no credibility to anyone who doesn't already agree with us.
I think, you know, I would even argue that we're seeing some of that with the Ukraine stuff now. I mean, India is starting to shift their position more towards Russia. China is. And we just look in general and wonder why so many other countries hate us. And I would argue that part of it is that we can be fairly hypocritical about these things.
We've spent a lot of time on this podcast talking about partiality. You know, I mean, it's one of the things that God talks about a lot throughout Scripture is that, you know, you should not be partial. You should not have two sets of rules. And I think one of the things that's just, it's really the easiest thing to be partial toward is yourself. Something that you're very clear. And obviously, you know, each person isn't the nation, but we identify with ourselves. We identify ourselves with the nation. We think of it as, you know, this is our country. This is who we are. We do these things. And I mean, it's so easy in a sense. I remember having this moment of epiphany when I was 20 some years old. I went down to Dallas. I was driving there. I remember I'd grown up in small towns, and I was trying to get onto the busy highways. And I remember when I would come down the ramp, I'd be so mad at people for not letting me in. And then the next day I would be driving on the road and someone would be coming down the ramp and they'd be trying to get in, and I'd be yelling at them for trying to get in. And I remember having that moment of going, when I'm on the ramp, I feel like someone should let me in. When I'm driving on the interstate and someone wants in, I feel like they, you know, I have the right of way. And at the same time, there's a law that governs who has the right of way. So there's an objective standard for what's right and wrong. And then, but my personal view is, in whatever situation I'm in, I'm right. And I think it's easy to go through. You can do that in every aspect of your life. And I think it's really easy to do that with your nation and just go, well, of course we're right. Of course we have justification for what we did. And that's frequently not true.
And I think, you know, you think about that objective standard and applying objective standards to nations. And, you know, the point of this isn't to say that Russia is okay when we proceed, if you haven't already figured out, to say a bunch of bad things about America. But the point isn't to say that because America has done bad things, therefore Russia can do whatever it wants.
Right.
But the point is to say, well, when we're having all this rhetoric, let's take a minute and think about what has our country done, and are we in a place to be saying that? Because maybe the things that are being said are even true things, yet, you know, maybe some of even those very politicians, they've supported things that are they all that different from what's going on there now in Ukraine?
And Charles, you said earlier just that Scripture talks a lot about this, and it'd be worth saying, you know, let's just go to the main verse. It's probably a verse most of our listeners are familiar with. It's the verse that may be the most quoted verse and the most taken out of context verse in the entire Bible, because it's a favorite of non-believers. But it's Matthew 7, verses 1 and 2. Judge not that you be not judged, for with what judgment you judge, you will be judged, and with the measure that you use, it will be measured back to you.
And we should just have that, you know, that expectation that that's one of the ways God judges. And if you're going to sit in judgment of somebody and say how evil it is what he did, then you should be expected to be judged by that standard. You should have that expectation to be judged by God. And I think we do this a lot. And I think because of that, our country should have some expectation, especially in foreign policy, because, you know, as Joshua was saying, we're going to say things about mostly foreign policy tonight. But I think if you look at other areas, there are areas where America has a very powerful and significant impact on the world. So we're not saying America's all bad. It's just a terrible country, blah, blah, blah. But there are, but at the same time, we shouldn't be naive about the country that we live in. We shouldn't like try to portray it as something that it's not.
It's easy to have an emotional response when people do these types of discussions. When, you know, when you have this type of discussion, and we've recorded an episode recently on emotion versus reason. And one of the important things just to realize is you should be able to objectively analyze things. You should be able to look at them without getting bent out of shape. You should be able to, you know, to just reasonably and honestly assess things. And I think that's kind of the goal here, is to say, without emotional response, without all these other things, what's right and what's wrong?
And I think that's really important, because, you know, when you think of the commandment to esteem others better than yourself, one of the most basic ways that you have to esteem others better than yourself, or at least equal with yourself, is how you judge. If you were in their position, would you say what they were doing was wrong? Because a lot of times we turn around, and I would say, you know, Putin's position, what he did was wrong. But yet he can turn around, I think, and say things about the U.S. where what we did was wrong. And so we need to be really careful. You know, Alan Dershowitz calls it the other foot test, even though I wouldn't recommend him for all kinds of things. But, you know, when he's talking about ACLU, he resigned from the board, even though he was one of the founders, because he said, look, they're supporting things that they can't say. Their position would stay the same if they were on the other side. Their position would completely change. And at that point, he said, I can't have any association.
We did a previous episode on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And in that episode, one of the things we talked about was just war theory, which is, you know, a pretty long-held view in Christianity of what is the right, you know, what are the justifications for going to war? And one of the issues is when you step away from that, when you step away from a principle of what God says about going to war, at that point, all you really have left is your national interest. And so there, and that's kind of what you're talking about, is if you were, you know, once you say, well, I did this because I was afraid they might do this to me, I did this because it would put us in a better position to do X, it's really hard to judge other people once you get to that point, because then you have to say, well, they didn't have justification to feel the fear that they had. But then you have to say, well, do I have the just, you know, I mean, it becomes this ambiguous place that you get into, and it becomes really hard to even evaluate what other people should do and what is right. And so, I mean, I think even as we talk about these things, you have to recognize you either have a hard objective standard and you hold everyone to it, or you have to be really loose and go, yeah, people just do stuff and that's all there is.
But I think the standard that America holds, which concerns me, is the standard of self-righteousness. If I did it, it is inherently righteous. And if somebody else did it, especially somebody that we have decreed through our media, through our politicians, decreed to be our enemy, they were unrighteous.
Right.
And that's become the standard. The standard is whatever I do is right, but whatever somebody else does, if we don't like them, it's wrong. And that's a really dangerous standard, because again, that presumes that there isn't a God who's sitting above it all and judging. And there is a God sitting above it all that's judging.
Right.
And I think a lot of it comes back to kind of ideology that's pretty common in America and all around the world, which is ends justify the means. There's certain principles that America operates on more than other countries that are good, at least in certain circumstances. Like, you know, communism was not a great thing, and America was standing against communism. But just because you're standing against communism doesn't mean that anything you do that you can say was against communism was the right thing to do. And so I think that we can make a list of here's some things that, you know, America might have this ideology based on our Christian history that's better, slightly better, a lot better, whatever you want to say, better than other countries. But the things that we've done to propagate that were not always good.
I do think that there is, because the Bible has influenced a lot of American culture, that there is certain constraints in domestic policy that actually end up affecting things. We have less corruption in our government than most governments, by far most governments. You know, there's areas where, you know, the idea of a contract, holding as a contract, these are areas that are biblical concepts that, because there are so many Americans that still have some understanding of that, they're enforced here more than they are most places in the world. You go to Russia and you sign a contract and it means nothing. Here it's decaying. It used to mean everything and now it's decaying. But But still, those things have advantage. But I do think a big shift happens once you leave domestic policy, because then the people judging it are not necessarily the citizens, except they're judging the information that they receive, which is not necessarily the whole story. When they're here, they can look at it and they can see the corruption, they can deal with the corruption. When it's something that's happening, it's been especially some of the things the CIA has done in various countries in the world where they've overthrown governments. I mean, these things are things that the Americans aren't even judging. A lot of times they don't find out about them until 10 or 20 years later. And so there isn't that constraint. And that's one thing that we should recognize is, you know, our system, one of the biggest advantages of the American system is there are really different constraints. And I don't mean the executive branch and the legislative branch and the judicial branch, because that's pretty much all governments. You know, it's the states have checks. There's balance of power between local governments and state governments and federal governments. There's all these things that are, you know, that we're seeing right now play out that,
with the coronavirus,
that work against each other.
Right?
Yeah, I mean, you can see it with the coronavirus. And that's a big advantage over a lot of countries, where a lot of countries it is just a central administration. You know, thinking about history this afternoon and what has happened and what America has done, I think there's some real parallels with what Russia's doing in Ukraine right now. I think there's actually things that are more directly parallel to what's happening in the Ukraine. But I think if we look right now, you know, even in the Iraq war, there's some real parallels between why Putin said that Russia had to invade Ukraine and why we said we had to go to Iraq. We said we had to go to Iraq because they had weapons of mass destruction, that they were working on doing missiles so that they'd be able to deliver them here, which, I mean, their missiles, that was pretty far off. They said that they kind of hinted that there was participation in 9/11. And so, yeah, they said Americans died because of it. They said we're at really great risk because of it. You know, these are the things that they were arguing. And you look at what Putin's arguing, and he's making a very similar argument. He's saying, look, we have Russian citizens in the two provinces that I think something like 11,500 have died there over the last 10 years since Ukraine violated their agreements, the Minsk agreements, I guess the last 8 years. They're saying that there's troops there that want to move into Ukraine if they join NATO. So we're going to have this huge threat. We should deal with it now before it gets to be a bigger threat later. Right? I mean, there's some real parallels between our arguments that we all say, those are great arguments, and then we turn around and we hear pretty much, you know, pretty similar arguments from Putin and say he's just an evil man for invading.
When you move away from an objective standard, you just have your national interests and your fears. To act like Putin shouldn't be afraid of NATO is kind of crazy. I mean, NATO's a lot more powerful than he is. And NATO likes to, NATO exists because of Russia.
Right.
And so, I mean, so there's this part of it where NATO, every single time they do anything, it's just this reminder to Russia, hey, there's a whole bunch of troops and the whole reason they exist is because of you. So it's not ridiculous for Putin to be afraid of them. And it doesn't mean that his fear is righteous, but it means if we did things out of fear, that's not any more righteous either.
And we go, you know, the media goes how all the Russians are against it because they had 1,500 protesters. And then Putin holds a rally that has 200,000 people supporting him. And the media goes, oh, they were just all forced to be there. Well, not really. And the reality is we can't put ourselves into their shoes and go, they saw a threat. They saw what happened in Poland. They saw other things where they see NATO troops right along the border of Russia. And they're going, we don't like this. And I suspect there's a lot of Russians that are going, it's right for Putin to go in there, just like there were a lot of Americans that said it was right for George Bush to go into Iraq.
And you might think, why would Russia be threatened by the U.S., you know, and NATO? Because haven't we told them we don't want to attack Russia? You know, we're at peace with Russia. Well, but, you know, have we ever told other countries that we're at peace with them and then later invaded them? Have we ever done it when we said there were these weapons of mass destruction? And then, you know, turns out looking back at that, there actually weren't, you know, did the Oops. Intelligence community, were they incompetent? Were they malicious? You know, to everyone else, doesn't really matter. They made it up, you know, whatever the reason was. You know, you go apart from that, you know, heads of state trying to assassinate heads of state. We've done that before of nations that we're not formally at war with. So, you know, the idea that we don't have the reputation from what we've actually done to back up promises of peace.
even now, sitting here after having thought about this, when I think about us going into the Iraq war, I can see parallels between us and Russia. My knee-jerk reaction is, we were right, they're wrong. You know what I mean? I mean, and that's how strong your association with yourself and your own ideas can be, is you just go, it doesn't matter. I'm sure we were right. I mean, you know, and yeah, they didn't have the weapons, but, you know, we were still threatened. Saddam Hussein wasn't a good person. So, I mean, my mind is just ready to supply me with a million justifications for it. And I understand that none of them are necessarily real justifications by some state. But I mean, that's how strong it is. I mean, so it's, I mean, it's
that's
it's hard
what Jesus Christ said. You know, he warns, do not judge lest you're willing to be judged by the same standard. I mean, that's a really important point. And I think a lot of Christians just reject that. They go, but this is our viewpoint, so it's all that matters. And that really is a total lack of humility. That really is self-righteousness and going, we're the good guys. We're the guys that wear the white hats in every situation. And I would go back and go, you know, in Ukraine, Putin's wearing a black hat. You know, in Iraq, the U.S. was wearing a black hat. And we need to accept that. And we need to recognize that when President Putin's hearing, well, NATO would never invade. Well, why do you have an army that's five times bigger than Russia's when its purpose is to stop Russia? Why would you have an army that big? I have no doubt that Putin has enough understanding of history that armies don't sit still. That's just not what armies are good at.
You would certainly be more afraid of NATO than you would be of Saddam Hussein.
Right. And then you turn around and you hear Putin hearing everybody in the West going, he's going to continue on into, he's going to attack Poland next. He's going to attack, you know, he's going to attack all these NATO countries next. And he's got to be going, they're trying to stir people up to war against me. Because that is what they were doing. That is what they are doing. Because would Putin attack an army that's five times his size? Really? That's why they have to say he's a madman. And we just need to recognize that. And again, this isn't saying that he's some great guy. I'm not saying that at all. He shouldn't have invaded. But it is saying, when you hear what the U.S. media is doing and you're sitting in Putin's situation, he'd have to be going, well, they stirred up all their people to invade a different country. Why wouldn't they stir up all their people to invade Russia? How do we stop them? We can't stop them. You know, they have five times bigger army. What we have to stop them with is we have to set up so that we can have a guerrilla warfare where you can drag it out. And so Ukraine's a good buffer.
And, you know, the parallels with between the accusations and facts of what Russia is doing and America's history are go beyond just invading countries. You know, there's these accusations, and I think, you know, legitimately so to some extent, that Russia is, you know, bombing civilian infrastructure, civilian areas. Well, you know what? The U.S. does that all the time. You know, we do it to take out a terrorist leader and then, oops, well, you know, sometimes we got it wrong and we just bombed, you know, a wedding or a funeral or this, that, and the other. You know, things happen. We make mistakes. You know, we kill thousands of civilians in other countries because we're trying to kill these bad people. And, you know, it goes way beyond just recent events, too. You know, over the 20th century, you know, thousands and thousands of people died. Civilians died because of the U.S. actions. You know, I was, you know, looking at Korea and Vietnam, you know, actually, they say millions of civilians died. Now, that's not all attributable to U.S. actions, but a lot of that is. And a lot of that is directly, you know, from bombs from U.S. planes killing civilians as a strategy. And, you know, that's, and we're complaining that Russia is doing this to, you know, they're saying 1,000 civilian casualties in Ukraine, perhaps more. You know, by the end of it, who knows how many it will be. But is it going to hit millions? Who knows?
I mean, you look at what we did in Vietnam with Agent Orange with, I mean, we would take places where we thought there were villages and just basically strip all the trees out using, you know, bullets at times, using defoliants. I mean, it was, we were very nonchalant about killing people in Vietnam.
Right. And, you know, to the U.S.'s credit, some people were prosecuted for war crimes.
Yes.
But many, many war crimes were committed, especially by the U.S.'s current definition when applied to Russia, than were ever prosecuted. You know, countless war crimes were committed by that standard.
Right. I mean, and one of the things that changed in Vietnam was the was the amount of video footage and actual footage of what was actually happening in war. If that had not happened, people would not have been tried for war crimes. You know what I mean? There's this part of it where, I think we, you know what I mean? You just, you also need to be honest with yourself and look at it and go, what caused that to change? It was not because all of a sudden because our military leadership had this sudden moral pang and go, oh, we can't conduct war like this anymore. No, it was more, oh, if we do this, everybody's going to see what war is like. And so, so there is this part of it where we need to even recognize what caused some of the changes.
You know, and another example that I thought of was the Cuban Missile Crisis, where you think about that. And basically, President Kennedy was threatening the use of nuclear weapons in order to stop Russia from putting nuclear missiles in Cuba, because he said, if you put something right next to me, this is a danger to me, so I'm willing to go to nuclear war with Russia over this. A far greater escalation than what President Putin ever suggested that he would do. And yet, that was just because we basically said, Cuba's ours. You're not allowed to arm anybody that close. Russia says, Ukraine is in our sphere of influence. You're not allowed to arm anybody that close. Only they didn't say, we're going to nuke Europe. And there's good reasons not to say that. But they didn't respond that way. But the U.S. did in similar circumstances. How dare you come right to our border, which wasn't as close as Ukraine and Russia.
Right.
Because there is the Caribbean Sea in between there. For those of you who are lacking in geography.
We don't have a picture, do we?
And you mentioned Cuba, and that brings to mind, Cuba-related thing that's still ongoing, which is Guantanamo Bay, where we have captured these people that we thought were terrorists, and we had took them to Cuba and, torture them. And even now, we can't bring charges against them to actually convict them of crimes under any, legal trial type thing, but we're detaining them indefinitely for years and years and years. And, presidents have promised they're going to shut it down, and they never do. And it's still there, and the people are still in Guantanamo Bay. A few of them are still in Guantanamo Bay. And, that if Russia, Russia holds its political opponents in prison. And, thankfully in the U.S., we don't do that typically. We're not arresting our political opponents that often. But we do, our international political opponents, we do that.
But for the last 6 years, that was the threat against Trump. There were two prosecutors that recently resigned from the New York District of Attorney's office because their boss that was newly appointed said, no, I'm not going to let you bring these charges against Trump because they actually don't meet the standard of evidence. And two of them resigned saying, how dare we not bring the former president, how dare we not bring charges? How dare we not charge him? So the idea that we wouldn't do that, we haven't, but that's because there's people who are going, you have to actually have evidence.
The January 6th, the thing that happened on January 6th, there are people who, there was a guy who just recently got sentenced. He didn't actually even enter the building. I don't think they have any evidence that he even did. They threw out the charge that he behaved in a disorderly manner. It was just that he was on the grounds outside the building that they could consider to be restricted grounds, and he's gotten 3 years probation.
6 months in prison and then and then 3 years of probation.
Right, and his 3 years of probation includes, he has to go through his probation office for any social media contact, which would also include him sending the text message. And there are people right now who are being held. They've been in solitary confinement for a year just because they were there. And there's a certain point where this becomes prosecuting your political prisoner. Your political enemies. There is this part of it where.
But it's good that the Democrats and Republicans can agree on something. They both agree these are political enemies.
Right. Some percentage of – right.
But it's true.
It is political enemies. It's not necessarily political party enemies, but it's
right.
But it's political enemies.
And, things are definitely different in Russia. I saw, a video of a protester being arrested in Russia because he was holding a blank piece of paper. The idea being in Russia, we don't need to hold up a sign because we hold up a blank piece of paper and everyone knows what the problem is, because they have really strict rules where, you have to apply for a permit, more than 7 days, but not more than 10 days. And so it makes it very hard to organize protests. Now, in the U.S., we are more free than that. But as some of the examples are saying, if we keep going down the path that we're going down, you know.
It's going to get much more difficult, and it's going to get much more onerous.
And not that you're are allowed to break into buildings, but you can identify certain, you know, the enthusiasm with which they're going after people and the lack of enthusiasm they have for going after other riotous protests in recent history and say, wait a second, you know, is this actually because this was worse, or is it because it's your political enemies?
I mean, really, the question with something like that is, what's the standard? And is the standard being appropriately and equitably applied across there?
And I can tell you that the standard punishment for that person in historical punishment has been a $50 fine.
When the people broke into the Kavanaugh hearing, right? When people actually stormed into, actually made it into where they were actually having the hearing, they gave them a $50 fine.
So that has been the standard for a long time, a $50 fine. So the one that I think is the greatest parallel would be the Mexican-American War. So what happened in the Mexican-American War is James Polk was elected president. And so Texas had split off. There was an area of Texas where...
Split off from what?
You know, split off from Mexico. And there was an area where Mexico and Texas was still debating whose territory it was. So Polk intentionally sent troops there so that Mexico would fire on them. And then the U.S. invaded and defeated Mexico.
This disputed territory.
No. They took the capital.
Of Mexico.
Of Mexico. Which is why I think it's the closest parallel. Texas had declared themselves an independent republic from Mexico. There was disputed territory between Texas and Mexico. Texas, the way they said Mexico approved, was that they took their captured general and forced him to sign a treaty that basically recognized Texas. So they said Mexico recognized Texas. And then Texas joins the United States as a state. And then James Polk ran basically on the idea that he would, you know, manifest destiny. He'd take the United States to the Pacific Ocean. So he intentionally sends troops into the disputed territory, or he intentionally sent troops into the disputed territory between where Texas was and the Rio Grande, where Mexico still was claiming they had, you know, land north of the Rio Grande. And then basically when the Mexican troops fired on them, he then used that as an excuse to basically invade Mexico, you know, and go out full in invasion and war against Mexico, which has so many parallels to what Putin is doing in Ukraine. Right, he's saying that these provinces have split off. He's recognized them as independent republics. Ukraine's still bombing them. He's saying he has to defend these people because they're mostly native Russians. And so then he puts himself in the position where he says, oh, we've been trying, you know, we've been fired on. We're going to go in as peacekeepers to stop this. And so we have to invade and try to take over the capital, which is basically what the U.S. did, taking over Mexico City.
And again, the point of this is not to justify Putin's actions. It's to say we need to be willing to look at ourselves and not go, of course, everything we did was right. Because, I mean, I've heard of manifest destiny growing up, and I remember hearing it in the sense of a little, you know, kind of still a rah-rah sort of.
You're definitely telling your age here, because, you know, that is not that is not modern school.
I'm not saying I heard it. That's the only thing I heard about it. But I'm just saying there are points where that's still the way it was described.
You know, there's obvious parallels between the Mexican-American War and the Russia-Ukraine War. But I think, you know, and I'm not, you know, an expert on that particular, you know, the justification for that conflict. But I think you could draw certain differences that, and in these types of things, small differences can have a huge impact. You know, you look at the way Russia did things, which is on, I might be getting my date slightly wrong here, but on Tuesday, they recognize the breakaway portions of Ukraine, and on Wednesday, they invade Ukraine, versus the United States recognizes Texas as a republic, and then I believe multiple years later, receive it as a state, then move in troops, and then the troops get attacked. So, you know, was the U.S. morally right in the Mexican-American War? Well, I'm not prepared to say that, but I will say there are certain differences between the one and the other.
If we're going to go that far back, if we're going to bring up the Mexican-American War, does the fact that there maybe, probably are some things that America did in that war that are not justified mean that I can't say anything about Putin? Does it mean that I can't make any kind of moral judgments because of this stain on my history?
No, I don't think of it as a stain.
I mean, I'm not. Our point is that he, I mean, what I mean is the point of it isn't to bring up this stain and have some sort of thing that you have to carry around with you. It's to be honest with yourself about your judgments.
My view would be we wouldn't judge that much differently now. We've had a history through the history of this country judging a certain way. And I don't think that we've all of a sudden matured so that as a nation we're going to be more interested in just war than we were in 1845. That's my concern.
And we clearly
I just see a pattern, and I just don't see any discontinuity. The pattern would be more my concern about making the argument. If we repented of what we did, sure, repentance is available.
Right, because, you know, you look at post-World War II Germany, and they did, you know, about face. And so they have legitimacy to, you know, accuse people of war crimes, at least to a certain extent. You know, they just because they had concentration camps 70 years ago doesn't mean that they can't say that people shouldn't have concentration camps now. But when you if you do have a history of something that you've never really stopped doing, that's when, you know, you can say, you know, we did it in this century and this century all the way to the present day. That's when you run into a problem. So it's not that because in your entire history as a country you did something bad. It's that, is there a pattern that is any different today?
So if I can just reconstruct that, what you're saying is that the purpose of looking at some of these deep history examples for the United States is that there are things that happened in the Mexican-American War that were then repeated in, say, Vietnam and Iraq, just to pick a few examples. And that because of that, you can sort of see this thread of, hey, we have a certain kind of international policy that there's a lot of similarities between what we have done and have continued to do with what it looks like might be happening between Russia and Ukraine right now.
And I mean, to go further in one sense, to say, look at how easy it would be to go to war with Russia. There was a lot of talk about creating the no-fly zone. Let's say the people who stopped the no-fly zone said, the reason we're stopping is if you do a no-fly zone, we will go to war. A no-fly zone is a declaration of war. But let's say they sold it to the American people as, we're going to set up a no-fly zone, which means we're going to shoot down Russian planes if they come into the area. So we shoot down a Russian plane, and we go, of course we can, because we set up a no-fly zone. And it would be sold to us as, we told them, this is a no-fly zone. And then they shoot down one of our planes, and we go, Russia has declared war on us. We told them this is a no-fly zone. We were very clear about it. We sent them a picture of a map with the area, and they flew in there, and then they shot us down. And all of a sudden, we'd be at war, and we would go, of course we can go to war. They attacked us. And I mean, and so would that be any different? You know, I mean, would that be any different than the scenarios we've talked about? But it would be sold to us, and our mind would immediately wrap around going, yep, they attacked us.
That, I mean, the way that you describe that makes me think of growing up with my brother and living in the same thing. It really is. You're living in the same bedroom, and we were marking off territory with masking tape on the carpet.
Yes.
And we had those no-fly zones.
He had to enter into your area to get to the bathroom, and that was an act of war.
There was dispute over where you put the masking tape because there's only one doorway into the room.
Right. I have annexed the entryway.
And the point of saying something silly like that is at no point in our disputes or negotiations were either one of us thinking about the interests of the other.
Right.
It was all very much, I am in the right. This is mine.
We both have tape. You know,
both peel up tape.
We're using the same means. But like I said, there's no consideration for the other.
And I think, you know, the best example of that is nuclear weapons. We, of course, have a lot of nuclear weapons. But if another country wants to get nuclear weapons, that is a threat to humanity. How dare you want nuclear weapons? You know, in fact, we will do everything short of bombing you to get you to stop trying to get nuclear weapons.
And we'll try to get Israel to bomb you, which is basically what we did in Iran. So we're not... Right. We're willing to go further than that. We just don't want our hands on it. And again, I think that goes back to our self-righteousness as a nation. We go, well, it's okay for us to have nuclear weapons because we'll always do what's right, which is why it's really important for Americans to be honest. Do we always do what's right? And yeah, it was 150 years ago, but it's also Texas is still part of America, and it still had real effects, and it had real effects on Mexico. And you know, New Mexico comes because of the Mexican-American War. I mean, we took territory away from them because we wanted to get to the Pacific Ocean. You know, and one thing that we have that's still the policy of the United States that crosses across all of this, Monroe Doctrine is saying that we basically said we have a sphere of influence that is all of North and South America. And so, you know, the ambassadors for the United States talk with the UK minister who was in Canada, you know, and he talked to the Russian minister, which had nobody over here, to basically declare to them that we're going to control all of the area south of us, which is all Portuguese, Spain, nothing to do with the parties that were being discussed. And so the president says, you know, in the discussions to which this interest has given rise and in the arrangements by which they may terminate, the occasion has been judged proper for asserting as a principle in which the rights and interests of the United States are involved, that the American continents, by the free and independent condition which they have assumed and maintained, are henceforth not to be considered as subjects for future colonization by any European powers. And so we basically said, they're all in our sphere of influence, and if you invade them, we will go to war. If you mess with their politics, we will go to war. And this is the one that, you know, in 1865, I think we overthrew, we funded the rebels in Mexico that overthrew Maximilian, because Maximilian, you know, France is the one that put him in charge. So we said, we have every right to overthrow a sovereign government because a European power got involved. And this is the one that ties together with the the Cuban Missile Crisis. That was the excuse there. And we've invaded Nicaragua. We've invaded Santo Domingo. We've invaded all kinds of countries saying, well, they're in our sphere of influence. And that is still basically the U.S. policy today. And Russia said, Ukraine's in our sphere of influence, so we can invade them because other powers are you know, trying to woo them to NATO and the EU. And so it's very parallel to what we said is the settled policy that everybody applauds and says, this is a good policy for the United States. But it's basically what Putin's argument was.
And, you know, American rhetoric today is quite idealistic. And I think in the early Republic, it was, you know, in terms of foreign policy, saying that we're supporting democracy versus other countries that are, you know, maybe a little more realpolitik about things. And I think in the early Republic, things were even more idealistic. And so I think the idea behind the Monroe Doctrine is you have these countries in South America that are declaring independence. And it's to say, well, you know, it's good. Independence is great. You know, we don't want Europe to control America. So we're just going to be like, you know, the big brother of North and South America, and we're going to help people out. So, you know, at least how it was sold, how probably some people were thinking of it, was not as a sphere of influence where America controls the Americas, but it's that we're just going to help there be liberty and justice for all. But, you know, you look at how that's played out over the years, especially around the world, and you see that, well, we like even today, we pick and choose when we're going to be pro-democracy and pro-revolution and pro, you know, getting more democratic forms of government, and when we decide we're going to support this nation that is a monarchy, say, and they have a king and they're trying to be overthrown to replace it with a democratic government, but we're going to support them because they're our allies. And so this thing that was idealistic in rhetoric, you know, you see more and more cracks in that, you know, ideal. I've used the word idealistic a lot of times, but I don't know of a great synonym. You see the cracks in the idea more and more as the years go by.
And there's a certain point where, like I said, your mind keeps supplying you with justifications for things. And my mind, as we were doing this, was going, well, you know, in the end, you can do things if you can get away with it. You know what I mean?
And I do.
And then you realize that's a horrible justification. But there's this part of it where you go, well, you know, Putin clearly tried something and he couldn't pull it off, or maybe
Are
he
you sure?
No, no. Well, that's what I'm saying is maybe he is going to pull it off, but in the end, that's really, you know, and so it becomes might is right, might makes right, you know what I mean? And that's not like a new doctrine. I just came up with that. Actually, if you use that, you have to send me money. But you know, I mean,
right.
It's easy to just, to let your mind fill in a, oh, this makes sense because of this. And America's powerful. So we've been able to do a lot of stuff. So that's good, right?
Depends on which side you're on. And that's part of the problem, is it depends on which side you're on.
And, you know, I think we had an episode on Afghanistan where we kind of talked about the whole democracy building thing and how the failure that was there. And, you know, the idea that you can go into a country and by sending them missiles and guns and ammunition that you're going to have a good country come out of that, or even sending them, you know, money or whatever you send them, that you're then going to be able to create the framework for a stable society that helps people, actually often does not really work out. You know, I don't know if there's that many great examples of the U.S. building strong democracies and countries that are peaceful and stable and not oppressing the people. You know, often they have a civil war, and then that's followed a few years by another civil war and another civil war and another civil war.
Or we do what we did in Afghanistan. I don't mean the second time. I mean when Russia went in, where we intentionally fed enough weapons so that Russia couldn't take over Afghanistan. So Russia basically bled themselves dry over 10 years, and the Russian government fell. Because this is basically, there's news reporters now, and we all know they're not the most truthful people, that are saying this is what the State Department, people in the State Department are saying that we should do in Ukraine, is just do what we've done the last 2 months. Keep feeding them enough weapons so that Russia can't take them over, that there's enough guerrillas, there's enough fighting going on, that Russia can never move forward, and in 10 years, the Russian government will fall. And so we should just do the same thing we did before. That was incredibly immoral when we did that in Afghanistan.
It was immoral to the people of Afghanistan.
Exactly.
That's what you're saying.
Russia deserved it, but you don't do that to a people where you keep them at war for 10 years. I mean, that's just incredibly cruel, where you give them enough so that they can continue, but never enough so that they could actually have victory. So all you do is keep them in a state of war. And, you know, right now I think that is the most likely outcome from Ukraine, is that we stay in a state of war for 2, 3, 4, 5, 10 years where we're not fighting the war. We're just causing Ukraine to be filled with war. And we just keep supplying weapons so that they keep the guerrilla fighting. I mean, even Robert E. Lee, when he surrendered at Appomattox, he said, I'm going to surrender the army so that they don't all go become guerrillas, or we can just continue to have war forever. And the United States kind of likes that when Russia goes into these places, is to keep it an ongoing war, because ongoing wars are really hard to fight. How much did we spend in Afghanistan? I mean, a huge amount of money. And Russia doesn't have that kind of funds. So it's a good way to kill a country. Well, that's not how you're supposed to do it.
The reason we can do that is because we're so much wealthier. Because we're so, you know what I mean? Because
right now.
That's what I mean. There's this part of it where, if you think about it, I mean, it's a really ugly picture. Someone who's really powerful, and then someone like Ukraine who's really weak, and you go, we're helping them. But you know you're not helping them. You know you're not actually doing what's good for them. And you know what I mean? It's a really, really bad picture.
So, I mean, to be clear, going, you know, to war on Ukraine's side and trying to invade Russia is going to have a worse outcome.
Oh, no, so, no, I didn't mean that we should go further.
Yeah, yes. Just to be clear that going further is not the answer, because who knows what would happen if you did that. I mean,
but it seems to me that the best terms for the Ukraine people are, you agree to never enter into NATO or the EU as a military alliance. You give them the two provinces, and the war stops. I mean, that's what Putin has said multiple times. And we're going, that's an unfair outcome. That's an unjust outcome. So keep fighting. And so I just see us as a place where we should really be asking ourselves, how moral are we? Is this, you know, one of the other things is the, you know, you don't, in just war theory, is you don't use a balance of weaponry so that the war never ends. That you have to fight to win it, and we don't want to fight to win Ukraine. And I'm not saying we should. I disagree. I mean, I would even more vehemently disagree with that. I'm just afraid that the United States has a recent history, and then, you know, God says you dig a trap, and then you fall into your own trap. We did it for Russia, where for 10 years they were in Afghanistan. And then guess what? We were in Afghanistan for 10 years, and we spent all kinds of blood and treasure to stay there for no results, just like Russia. One thing that I think we should talk about that's a major part of this is, you keep talking about, you know, you have this knee-jerk reaction. And I think Christian churches frequently have the knee-jerk reaction that we're the good guys. And that I've been in churches where that's taught. A lot of that is taught, that we're always the good guys because, you know, we're the Christian nation, not Russia. You know, and especially since Eisenhower, you know, basically tried to make the Cold War between the atheists and the Christians by adding, you know, one nation under God to the Pledge of Allegiance. There's this view, and I think the churches propagate it, and we should be careful about propagating that view.
And one of the tests that you can see if your church is that is, do they have an American flag up front? You know, are they honoring the state of America in the worship service?
Right,
putting a flag up.
And you know, you look at in Nigeria, you have these I've seen it in Christian hotels that are run by a church, and one thing that other countries do a lot of, that we don't do so much here, thankfully, is, you know, you put a picture of the president up in your hotel. And you have, you know, a hotel that's run by the church, and they have a picture of the Muslim president in their hotel. That's kind of the same thing, except thankfully we don't have a Muslim as our president right now. Not that, you know, a Catholic is that much better than Muslim, but that's a discussion for another day. But, you know, that's kind of a even worse example of that.
When I would go to Vacation Bible School, we would pledge allegiance to the flag. We would pledge allegiance to the Christian flag. You know, so we would pledge allegiance to the United States flag, to the Christian flag, and then we would pledge allegiance to the Bible. We, you know, every single Vacation Bible School that we did. But, I mean, we made sure you hit
that's
all.
That's a pretty standard Southern Baptist thing, or right. Independent Baptist in your case. But, I mean, even, you know, in Nigeria, it wouldn't surprise me because a lot of countries have it law that you have to put up the picture of the president in hotels, which is just an insane law. But if we're too jingoistic about how great America is, we should expect the same laws here.
I mean, the other issue that you're talking about is there's a real danger when your view is you're the good guy. You're putting yourself in a position where God's going to judge you more harshly. You know, I mean, if your position is, I mean, if you say we're a city set on the hill, we're the place that has light, the reason why these other countries are evil is because they're places of darkness. God's not partial, but God does say, I'm going to judge you to whom much is given, much is required. And so there's this part of it where we're this country where we're the city set on the hill, we're the place of light, we're the place of goodness, and yet we're going out and we're doing these things, and we think that means we can't do wrong. And God goes, do you remember the country? Do you remember the nation that I said was my people? The one, you know, I destroyed them. I destroyed them because they were a city set on a hill, and they did not do what was right. They did not do what was just, and I destroyed them. And so, I mean, there is this part of it where it's a really bad position to put yourself in, to hold yourself up as this thing, and then to say that makes you where you can't be judged for your evil. God does not believe that.
I mean, one effect of that idea of we're the good guys is that when we see Europe and stuff hating Americans, and there's a lot of countries that really hate Americans, our response is almost like we're being persecuted for righteousness' sake. The reason that they hate us is because we're the good Christian nation, and they hate us because they're the pagan atheists. Instead of going, maybe they hate us because we invade their countries. Maybe they hate us because we have the CIA go in there and play around with their political process. We corrupt their elections. We do all these various things that are not very righteous. And so when you start to blind yourself to say, we're the good guys, it also then assigns motives to other people that reinforce that and make you feel even better about yourself. We're being persecuted for righteousness' sake.
And, you know, there's a whole other side to this, you know, where some people say America's, you know, the almost chosen people. And then now you have a lot of people who say America is kind of the worst thing ever. You know, America can do no right. Not necessarily the recent political leadership, but in our history, we are the bad guys always. And I, you know, the reality is, you know, you need a more nuanced approach, you know, yes, people have been oppressed in America's history. America has oppressed other countries. America has wrongly invaded other countries. But, you know, you look at something like, you know, the Native Americans, and you can find plenty of examples where the Native Americans were oppressed. You can also identify a lot of ways that the Native Americans were greatly helped by what becomes the United States. And so, you know, you need a balanced approach. And so to make our country holy or to make it, you know, completely reprobate, neither of those is accurate. And it takes, you know, a detailed look at these things when the situation calls for it.
And what you need for that balanced approach you're talking about is you need an objective standard. That's, you know, there are ways you could get a balanced approach, which is just, instead of my interests, I'll look at your interests, where really you need a biblical standard. That's how you get a balanced approach. That's how you judge things objectively. That's how you can say, yes, America's good at this. America's not good at that. Yes, Russia's good at this. No, Russia's not good at that. Ukraine's good at this. Ukraine's bad at that. It's by saying, well, what does God think about it?
And I think there's a part of it where the reason why you should never be that judgmental of America is because it goes back to the thing at the beginning is judge not lest ye be judged. And there's this part of it where you shouldn't look. I mean, I grew up hearing that Russia was the evil empire. They, you know, and so there's this part of it where you look at them as if they don't even have a right to exist. That's a really wrong view to have about any nation, that they don't have a right to exist. I mean, God can judge them
in that
way.
It really means that you're saying that God did not appoint their leaders.
Right.
And we know he appointed Nero. I mean, Putin is not Nero.
And so there's this part of it where it's wrong to judge America in that way because you're not judging according to any standard that you could judge everyone by. You have to judge America according to a standard that you could judge every nation by, which means nations can exist. One of the principles we talk about a lot is having authority means you get to make bad decisions. You actually have the authority to make bad decisions with your authority. And God's the one who actually judges finally and judges and determines things in the end. But you have to apply that to America too. And so you shouldn't come back to America and go, that's what I meant when I said that when you look back at Mexico, the point of it isn't that it's a stain. I mean, it is. You can look back at it and say there are stains on our history. But the point isn't to go, we've got stains in our history. Okay, shut it down. We just all have to just lay down and die because
they're
the
Ukrainian citizenship.
Right. I mean, that's not the answer.
But it's if you don't have an objective standard to appeal to, it's what you're left with.
Yes.
Is you're left with either it's the evil empire or there's no difference at all between us.
Right.
And we're all the same and
let
neither
is true.
Burn down. Right.
And the problem is that, you know, when the church is just going, America is the standard, which I've been at a lot of churches that are almost like that America is the standard of a righteous nation. We are the, you know, like you were saying, the chosen people. But it's the church's job to hold up that objective standard. It's the church's job to say, no, this is what God says is just, and this is what God says isn't just. And when the church instead just becomes a cheerleader for the state, there's no check on the state, and the state stops becoming, there's no way to call the state to repentance when the church is just a cheerleader. It's really crucial that the church be the one that actively maintains that objective standard, because God is objective in his standards. He's unbiased in his judgment.
And there is a chosen people. I mean, the church is the chosen people of God.
That is the light of the world.
And it's not the church in America. It's not the church that you go to. It is those who are saved across the entire earth are the chosen people of God. And if you make anyone else the chosen people, you're at war with God over who the church is. And that's a really bad place to be too.
I mean, one other thing that I've seen happen in churches is the churches want to rewrite past American history to make it better than it was.
Better?
And there were some.
Could it be better?
Could it be better? And there, you know, the American Revolution, there were righteous men in the American Revolution, people that were arguing it from biblical principles. But then you have somebody like Benjamin Franklin that during the French-American War, he's saying that Parliament has absolute authority over all the colonies. And then during the American Revolution, he's saying Parliament has no right, taxation without representation. I mean, and he was purely practical. It was whatever seemed to fit the moment. And, you know, most of the generals in the American Revolution, they were in it for glory. They weren't in it because of some principles or anything like that. I hear people saying they're coming from a Christian perspective, but they're not coming from the perspective of we must show the real truth. And if you want to come from the Christian perspective, that is the Christian perspective. I mean, we did one on teaching history to your children. But the reality is, if you want to know history, want to know history. Don't want to know some hagiography that somebody comes up with to talk about how great we were, how great these generals were. A lot of them were very petty people.
Right. There's a much smaller number of really righteous people than you've learned history through Christian sources, there were a lot smaller number of really righteous people in the American Revolution and our founding than you've been told. And like you said, there were ones, and there were a lot of people.
And some of them had huge influence.
Even Benjamin Franklin was constrained by the church.
You can understand the mistake of saying that it was a Christian nation, because people like Adams and Jefferson, who clearly weren't Christians, and by their own profession weren't Christians, weren't Orthodox, were still heavily influenced by Christian culture and still made decisions that you could say, look, that decision is influenced by biblical principles in ways that are so far from anything that we're used to experiencing right now. That's why we look back and say, oh, look, that it was a Christian nation. Well, kind of.
Right.
It was a nation that was biblically literate, is
right.
What I would say was probably the most significant part of us as a nation that really set us apart. Wasn't even that we were that good at the practice of religion. We weren't. But we were a biblically literate society. And that has a huge influence on the society and the huge constraint, like you were saying. You look at Jefferson and Adams, and both of them are pretty petty people. But yet they were still really constrained because the society had a knowledge of the scriptures.
I mean, and specifically when you're talking about learning history through Christian sources, I mean, the one I was most familiar with was Wall Builders and David Barton. And I'm not saying that everything that he said is false and everything he said is worthless, but David Barton saying he wears rose-colored glasses is too weak. I mean, I think he's been willing at times to overlook real historical facts to fulfill his agenda, and he's done it. He did it specifically with Thomas Jefferson. But I mean, this is what I meant when you kind of said, who could you say that about in history who you know was saved? That's kind of the problem, is people think all the founding fathers that they know they were saved, and I think that's part of the issue is the way they're presented, the way they're sold to you. You know, I grew up reading there's a whole different series of Christian biographies, and all of them just make the people, you know, they're just pure Christian from beginning to end. And I don't know how accurate most of them are. I mean, I've a lot of the things I remember from them, I kind of go back and go, I don't think some of this was true. I think they just made stuff up, because I've read more detailed biography since then.
I think it's really easy to look at things and see them as you want them to be. And in a real extent, it can be even more powerful when you as a nation do it, which is what our foreign policy usually ends up being, is this is how we violate all the Indian treaties and everything else, is as a people we go, but this is the right thing to do. We're obviously been chosen by God to rule over all those lands out to the Pacific Ocean. And we should recognize that the church a lot of times participates in that. And the church should really be answering to God and saying, what does God's word actually say? And far too often the church has said, you know, we're just going to go along with the mob.
I'd say the sum of what I'm getting out of this podcast is, at the end of the day, use a biblical objective standard to judge what's happening between Russia and Ukraine right now. Absolutely. And don't forget American history in that. But really, for me, the point where it's going to matter is when the next thing happens, is I have to remember, okay, here's what I thought about what Putin was doing. Here's what I thought about Ukraine and Zelensky. Here's what I was thinking then. I was making judgments. I was using a standard. And am I willing to be consistent for the next thing? Am I willing to be consistent when America decides to intervene in some other
When they do establish conflict. A no-fly zone, when they do, when they
that's
do
what I was going to say. I think right. There'll be the next thing in Ukraine when we decide that we're going to continue to supply weapons for the next 10 years. What are we as a people going to say? We're going to say that's okay to keep a low-grade war there, because that at least it doesn't involve us. So what? The Ukrainians die. So what? That they have the massive destruction that comes because of war. I mean, I think that the next thing is not like. It's not necessarily 10 years away. It could be the decision that President Biden's wrestling with right now. And what is the church going to say?
And we shouldn't think that what the church is going to, what the church says has no influence. The church is, I mean, we can look at the church and we can say they're weak. I mean, whenever you were talking about manifest destiny, one of the things I was thinking of was, if God wanted the United States, if God's desire was for the United States to stretch from coast to coast, God can cause those things to fall into our hands. It's not hard for him at all. God can work so that those things fall into our hands in a righteous way. And I think there's this part of it where the whole reason these things happen is because we don't believe in the sovereignty of God. We don't trust in God. We believe that we have to get these things by our machinations. We have to, that we have to get them by stratagem, by, you know, whatever way we can. So, you know, we don't want Ukraine to be a buffer for Putin. Instead, it'll be a buffer for us, and we'll use the Ukrainian people to keep Russia busy. And that's much more satisfying to us than letting him get his way. You know what I mean? And so there's just this part of it where we turn away from trusting in God, and we turn towards relying in what we can cause to happen. And I mean, I think that in the end, that's really where it comes from. And the church needs to turn away from that. And we actually can have influence.
Truth is very influential. And we pretend like it's not. But the reality is that you can pierce through some of these things by just having saying some of the statements that we say, even though, like you said, even at the beginning, you were saying, you know, your heart's wrestling, going, no, wait a second. No, we were right. It was right. Different. But the reality is that, you know, speaking about these things, and, you know, that's why I thought it was worthwhile doing the podcast, is speaking about these things so that we get perspective. You can change people's minds. You can say, were we happy that Pakistan and Iraq and Iran and these countries were feeding weapons to the Taliban so we stayed in Afghanistan for 10 years? If we weren't happy about that, then would we be happy about doing that to Ukraine? I mean, is that, you know, and some of these things, they are arguments that they're really understandable arguments, I guess is what I'm saying. And part of the way that the church needs to not just say, this is truth, but say, you know, let me walk through and reason why this, you know, does this make sense? Do you see this? Because that's how we start to have a more just foreign policy, is the church needs to declare what justice is. The Bible, when it says what the duty of man is, it says to do justly, to love mercy, and to walk humbly before God. When we think about American foreign policy, we should be holding the United States, the church should be holding the United States to doing justly and walking humbly. Too often the United States hasn't done either. And I'm not saying other countries have. They haven't done it either. The only way that changes is when the church starts to say, this is what justice is, and starts to speak to these things. We have to hold up the objective standard, and the church is the only one that can do it. Thanks for listening.
This has been The Conquering Truth, a project of Reformation Baptist Church. If you found this helpful, you can visit us online at theconqueringtruth.com and subscribe here or in your favorite podcast app. Thanks for watching.